Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, regular listeners, you may have spotted that we've changed our name. It's now Honey & Co. The Food Sessions.
So if you hear this sound, it's just us making dinner.
Well, that and the fact that we're not allowed to use our old title anymore.
It's just been a bit of a thing, but don't worry about it.
We hope you enjoy the show.
Just don't touch my kids.
Who run this mother? Who run this mother? Who run this mother?
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Honey & Co. I'm Sarit Packer. This is the first of our series, Who Run the World, where we celebrate women in food. Since the start of Honey & Co., women have reigned supreme. They run our kitchens, our front of house, and our offices. And we finally feel that the industry is starting to catch up with us, as women are now leading their way across the industry, not just as chefs, as food critics, as writers, as culinary teachers, TV and radio presenters, and so much more. So, with International Women's Day on the horizon, we wanted to dedicate a whole series to some of the women that inspire us every single day. Today's guest is Andy Oliver. She's the most vivacious and beautiful person we've had a chance to meet this year. The interview with her is absolutely hilarious. Itamar and I were arguing which one of us would do it, and he won. But he talked to her about her career in a punk band and how she made the transition to a chef and then to a food broadcaster. Her show, The Great British Menu, is one of our absolute favorite. If you haven't seen it, it's a competition between top chefs. You should seriously watch it. We spend hours arguing about what we would make and how we would do this. You'll be shouting at the screen like we do. I was especially fascinated by how she managed to get where she has and how she broke this glass ceiling. We're also so excited to hear that she's working on a current project collecting recipes from all around the Caribbean. So whether you guys are in the kitchen cooking while you listen, whether you're driving or walking your dog, I hope you enjoy this episode.
So tonight, guys, we are joined by the wonderful you that came to hear, the wonderful Andy Oliver, yay! Who is a musician, a chef, a broadcaster, a trailblazer, and now a documenter of recipes as well.
That's kind of my historian
for the future.
It's my newest obsession, yeah.
Your newest obsession. But let's start from the beginning. Your early career was in music.
Yeah.
And quite like alternative, you were doing punk, you were doing, what were you doing?
I don't know what you would really call it. But you know, it's interesting because we never felt like we were particularly alternative or bit, you know, I was a punk. I grew up in Suffolk in the 70s and, you know, it was like punk or die, really. You kind of had to go one way or another. So I chose punk because I felt quite lost prior to that. I was in Suffolk, it was the 1970s, as you can imagine. It wasn't that diverse, okay? So I was like the only black girl for about 100 miles, you know? So it was like finding something or some place that I felt like I could sit within. And the Slits and the Clash came and played in Bury St. Edmunds and it completely blew my mind. And I really see that actually as the sort of spark point for most of my life because I was, oh, because I used to start thinking, why can't you just do whatever you like? why do you have to do what all these people tell you? And then I went to all the slits of the class and they went, you don't have to. And I was like, I knew it. I knew it. And so I
nobody
was,
tells you
I
this.
Knew it. I knew it. Nobody told me, but I found out anyway. And I was absolutely thrilled. And it sort of set me on a path of sort of trying to claim my fire and hold on to it and to really seek out that in myself, actually. And I, so I think punk for me was a really important moment. And then when I came to London and I met Nana Cherry, who's, you know, my sister friend, she absolutely introduced me to real liberation, actually, as a young woman, because she came from this real hippie jazz, like proper jazz kind of life background. And then we met each other and sort of fell in love. And kind of, it was like we found a reflection of ourselves in each other in some kind of way. And that friendship really gave us the strength to be whoever we needed to be. You know, we would take our shoes off and tuck our dress into our knickers and dance and just go nuts, basically. But it was... it was like medicine. Yeah. It wasn't like for the, oh, we're so crazy. It wasn't really like that. It was more just like a desire to run that fire out and to really try to put a name on it and try to really find our own language and our own way through, basically.
I love
so,
that line, run that fire out.
It was a bit like that, though, and I think we were like that for a long time.
Was there a model or was there someone or something out there that you said, this is what we need to be, or was it all completely new territory?
I think in part it was completely new territory. The other day, Nana has three daughters, and one of them, Mabel, is like a really big pop star now. And we were at her record album launch the other day. And there was all these amazing young black girls everywhere, really groovy. And Nana looked at me and she went, do you remember when it was just us? And I said, I do, yes. We used to go out, you know, and it was a kind of, that in one way there was like crashing through some sort of thing. In another way, it's a spirit that's been around for decades and decades. You know, people like Bette Davis and, you know, all those jazz greats, Alice Coltrane. And, you know, some of those women were just extraordinary. And, you know, Nikki Giovanni, a poet like Nikki Giovanni, a writer like Toni Morrison. It's not just about one path. It's about an attitude to living. And I think one of the things what I started to say when I started talking about when I met Nana and I met her family was that I realized there was a universe of people who were my people who also didn't want to do what as they were told, essentially.
Your clan is out there.
Yes, my clan. And when we all have a sort of tribal way of living in the world, don't we? You know, you kind of move towards, you seek out people that you recognize or mirror you in some kind of way or that inspire you. And it just sometimes takes a little longer to find them.
So you were doing music. You got somehow into music TV presenting. You got into that
Yes, I did a show called Badass TV with Ice-T, which was on Channel 4. Do you remember what was it called? Euro something. There was a weird show. Euro Trash. That's the one. Thank you. Good job you're here. And it was like a kind of black version of Euro Trash. People got very upset about it because it was really inappropriate. But in the best possible way, I think. You know what I mean? I like things to be a bit inappropriate.
If you're not inappropriate, oh my God, if you're not inappropriate,
what are we doing? Exactly. Yeah. So people got a bit upset about it, but it was the best fun. I had the most hilarious time with Ice-T, who spent most of the time having his ponytail tonged, let me tell you that. Not really that gangster, but anyway, he was a really funny guy.
I mean, that is gangster.
It's pretty deep gangster. You know those guys with the rollers in there and stuff. And he was really funny. We just had a really hilarious time doing it. And I think from then I kind of moved between doing that and a bit of radio and a bit more TV here and a bit more radio there. And I realized that for me, it all comes from the same place, making music, broadcasting, making food, whatever it is, it's about your own truth and finding your own voice and finding a way to express yourself in the most effective way possible. And that can be through a plate of food. It can be through a song. It can be through a dance. It can be through a really little lunch with your family or, you know, wherever. As long as there's breath and truth in it, then you'll feel good. That's kind of what I worked out.
Let's talk about the food, because now you're kind of most recognized for your work in the field of food. Was this always there, or...?
Food's always been always, there. It's always been there. We were talking downstairs and I said that Nana and I were very weird. I mean, we were teenagers, really. And, you know, we'd be going to have a party and then the guys came in and they'd be like, what is that in the bath? You're like, it's mackerel. It's like, why are there 60 mackerel in the bath? Like, oh, we're making this great dish we saw, you know, and that's not normal for 18-year-olds,
Like, have you heard of salted peanuts?
Do you know what I mean? We'll be having dinner, we're making coconut rice and a really great Thai mackerel thing, and we're making, you know, we would lie around reading cookbooks to each other down the phone or like on, you know, wherever. It was just like our another escape route and another way of finding beauty, I think, and simple beauty, because that's the great thing about cooking, isn't it? It's the alchemical nature of cooking that I love, that you can take two things or three things that don't sound like they should be together and create some new explosion that is just a sort of moment of wonder on a Tuesday afternoon.
Yeah.
And we all need a moment of wonder on a Tuesday afternoon.
More than any other moment.
Well, it's
aside from Wednesday morning.
Oh, that's
a whole nother story.
So I think when Nana and I, we did a cooking show together on the BBC,
yeah,
and had the most amazing time. And then she went back on tour and I was like, I'm really into this. So I started doing supper clubs around East London. We did this thing called the Movable Feast, and my boyfriend, my partner, used to have a place called Cordy House, which was on Curtin Road before Shoreditch became daftly, ridiculously fancy pants and expensive, but it was still dirty and great and, you know, inappropriate. Yeah. We're back to inappropriate again. But it was a sort of double fronted building, and it was like five floors of warehouse right in the middle of Curtin Road. They basically rented it for about £5 a year. They just let them have it, turned it into a kind of art collective space, Mutoid Waste Company.
Not something that you can imagine in London these days.
No, you couldn't get that space. It was just like, I think it's turned into some really weird, creepy adult ballpark. I went past it the other day and I was happened?
Yeah.
No, he's weird. Anyway, that really freaked me out.
I don't know the building, but there's probably a brewery in the basement.
There's probably a brewery. Yeah. Some like artisan brewery in the basement. But we, you know, so there we could do all sorts of things because there was rooms of all shapes and sizes. We did like a sort of psychedelic Village Fate on the roof for one of them, like a Mexican. It was insane, but great, because we had space, we could experiment, you could play, you could do whatever you want. And I think that actually is something that was constant throughout most of my young life in London. There was always space. You know, we used to do like warehouse parties in the back of King's Cross in a street called Battlebridge Road. And we used to have the best parties. It was £1 to get in, £1 for a beer. You pay the police, you pay everybody, and you know, it was great. And the parties would go on all night and nobody cared, because who cared about the back of King's Cross in the 80s? Nobody.
Well, I'll tell you who does now.
Now.
It's Facebook that cares, because they own it.
Exactly.
So you kind of exploded into the world of food, and so much energy went into that. You did your supper clubs, you got into food broadcasting really quickly.
I mean, we did a couple of pubs. We had a pub on Columbia Road, and then my friend got another pub in Homerton, and then we did the restaurant for that pub in Homerton for a while. And then we were doing like people's weddings and different little pop-up things here, there and everywhere. And then one day I got a call. There was a weird program on ITV called Food, Glorious Food that lasted one series. And I went and did a guest judging because Hugh, what is that guy's name? No, the other dude that makes pasta sauce.
Grossman.
Thank you.
I was thinking like Paul Newman.
That guy. Lloyd Grossman couldn't do it one week, so they rang me and said, will you come and do this thing? So I said, yeah, okay. Went and did it, had a really good time, and then just obviously forgot about it, whatever. 5 years later or something, I got a call from two people they'd basically tried to give me Lloyd Grossman's job, and ITV insisted that it was Lloyd Grossman. I didn't even really know about the drama. They were runners then, and then they'd come right up and they were executive producers on Great British Menu and called me up and said, will you come and have lunch? We want to talk to you about being a guest judge. And I thought, that's a fancy for one little day. Think, sure, sure. Went and had lunch, and they said the executive producer is coming. I was like, really? But hey, lunch is lunch.
Yeah.
Where are we going? Fantastic, I'll see you there.
And, where are we going? I don't care. It's
I don't
lunch.
Care. It's lunch. And they said, well, Prue is leaving, and do you want her job? And I was like, excuse me? Sorry to just offer me Prue Lee's job. And they did, and they had, and I had a couple of other dinners. It was very nice. They just kept feeding me.
And
then you got to
eat.
And then I started.
Yeah, and then
you
got the
gig,
and you haven't stopped with lunch
since. I haven't stopped eating since.
I want to ask you more about that in a second. But this whole area, up until very, very recently, was completely male-dominated.
Yeah.
The whole area of food broadcast, yeah. I can't think of anyone except Nigella.
Well, it's Delia, Nigella,
yeah.
Fanny, Corolla Fanny.
Yeah. But you think, you know, a lot, of, you know, the master chef, you know, is,
yeah.
you know, Monica Galletti, of course, was, yeah. you know, amazing with the eyebrows. It's changed our world. But it is still the majority is men. Is this a reflection of the industry of food or a reflection of the TV industry?
I think it's both. Yeah. I think it's a reflection of both. And I think that, as women, we've been allowed a sort of, interesting, you know, Fanny Craddock, kind of a cartoony character. Delia, also a bit of a cartoony character. Even Nigella, who I love
side,
and adore.
Yeah.
But there's a way that Nigella is talked about and framed within the food industry. Not so much now, but certainly previously.
Yeah.
That was based on a lot of it on her sexuality all the time. The woman's like an incredible cook. She's making this amazing food and you're talking to me about...
An incredible writer. Well,
and a writer. Why are we talking about whether she sucks her fingers or not? I don't care. Do you know what I mean? So I think that as women, we're quite quickly pushed into some sort of cartoon role version of ourselves, you know? So I think that there's been a moment internationally, actually, I think all over the place, women are coming through with our own voices, our own decisions, our own thoughts, our own ways of doing things. And I think in the food industry, actually, the whole street food sort of explosion has opened up so much for people. It meant that you didn't have to have backers. You didn't have to have huge amounts of money to start the restaurant. You could get a van, literally, and kit it out and start doing your duck rolls.
You didn't need to be establishment.
You didn't need to be established. You could start, and you also didn't need to have come through one particular route, you know, classicism, so-called classicism, which I have an argument about anyway, because, you know, when people go, well, I'm a classic cook, it's like, what does that mean? What do you mean by that? Do you mean you were taught French cookery? That doesn't mean you're a classic cook. It means you know how to cook French food.
Yeah.
You know, there's people all over the world making classic Caribbean food,
yeah.
classic African, you know, all over the continent of Africa, all over Italy, all over Spain, making incredible food. You're not a better chef than them because you put more butter in.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
there's kind of an imagined hierarchy.
Yes. Which I take, which is nonsense. I mean, it is nonsensical. And actually, interestingly, when I do Great British Menu, that's really evident because there are people who sometimes have come through that route and, you know, they fall at the first hurdle because there's a lot of creativity involved and you have to be innovative and you have to be able to think on your feet. And sometimes people who come through quite a rigid form of training aren't able to do that because they've had it beaten out of them.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they're taught to.
No, but also it's a different
mentality.
Mindset.
Yes,
different
absolutely,
mentality.
Because it's just about precision. And, you know, there's a beauty to it.
Mm-hmm.
And people who've like come up and trained for years and years, I absolutely have the utmost respect for them, but it's not the only way.
This is what I always think about the world of food and the conversation about food is that it's a true democracy in a sense. Of course, there's, you know, there's the financial element and all politics go into it, but it's open to everyone.
It's open to everyone. And I think
class
it's
system there.
Like anything, it's about the detail, isn't it? You know, when I walked in here, I've never been here before, and I walked in here
crazy?
And I went, I am. I am.
Where have you been all your
life? I've been tired. Yeah. I told you, I was saying to him, I've never been. He said, what do you mean? And I said, well, you know, I get like, people go, do you want to go out for dinner? I'm like, not really. Like, do you want to go out for a drink? I'm like, not really. So what do you want to do? Lie on the floor, actually. I'm exhausted.
And have a little cry.
And
like
have a little
normal,
cry and watch Law
like
and Order.
Like a human being.
Exactly. So, but you know, the first thing I noticed when I walked in here was the detail. It's like beautiful little gorgeous things, the shells and the little spices. And I just got like, it's like a treasure trove in here. It's just wonderful. And that, to me, is sort of one of the most perfect things in the world. You walk into something, I just want to stay and dig and discover. And this is a real beautiful thing.
Yeah, it can do a lot of damage to
your
wallet.
Yeah, I could real fast.
Yeah, no, I'm really happy that it's my shop, because otherwise it will destroy me.
You would just be here all the time.
Otherwise I would be destroyed here. I'll be ruined.
I know. I'm going to get those spoons. See, look, they're by your head. See, look, up, to the left, the little gold spoons. Spoon. Look, how cute are they?
You don't have a home if you don't have tiny gold spoons.
I need tiny little gold spoons.
Yeah, you can't.
I do love a good spoon.
Yeah.
It's as important. Long as it's
tiny, holy, and golden.
Yes.
Yeah. Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
But I want to go back to British Menu, because me and Sarit have been watching every single season. And we're the ones that are like, get super competitive. We shout at the screen. We do that in the Bake Off as well. But the Great British Menu is our original love.
People get very, very impassioned over the chefs that they love. I do. I start thinking they're all my children. I get really maternal, because they put so much into it. And, you know, I find them crying in the hallways sometimes, you know, when they haven't got through. And it's because it's tough, and they are tired, and they have people pointing cameras at them and asking them stupid questions all week. And they just, you know, when they go through all that and they get to the end and then they don't get through, it's like heartbreaking.
Yeah.
So every week we break someone's heart.
Yeah, and
isn't that terrible? But you also make someone happy.
These are people at the top of their game.
Top of the game, who are used to winning.
They are gods.
And they are gods. They are used to winning everything, always, most of them. So they're very rarely in competition with each other.
Great. And this is the nation watching.
And the nation watching. This is the 50th season. And so some of the chefs on there now sort of grew up watching it and wanting to be on it.
Yeah, for me, I think it's amazing. And actually, I think the impact it has on the industry is incredible. But what I really wanted to ask you, do you eat all this stuff?
Oh, right. So I have a method.
Okay.
Because you have to, and especially in finals week, because you have 8 chefs. Starters are okay. Fish is okay. You get to mains. By 3, you're like, oh my God, how many more? And then you get dessert day. And dessert day is actually the hardest because of all the sugar. And Matthew looked at me and he went, oh, I long for something savory. I long for a sausage. It's like, all right, Matthew. Matthew Fort, who is one of the best human beings in the world, by the way. So after that first year, when I didn't listen to anybody, I now have 3 bites tops of everything, because you can't.
No.
You just can't. Three bites is enough to be able to have everything on the plate and to be able to evaluate it fairly and properly. And then you have to stop to make sure that you're fair as well.
Yeah.
And that, because you know, you want to do...
No, but you want to give them their dues and you want
to
do justice.
Because they work so hard. It's incredibly important to me.
And this is actually what I do love is that the Great British Menu always respects the chef so much. It must be such a privileged position. I mean, you have the best of the country. You must get so much as a cook.
It's inspiring. It's really inspiring to be around a whole bunch of other cooks who are at the top of their game and who are really pushing their creativity, because it really makes you think about, oh, maybe I could take the cardamom and we could make a infusion. You know, my brain does start going. You do start to think about different ways. And the other thing, of course, is that it goes the other way as well, when you realise that there's something, like last year it was meadow sweet. Meadow sweet doesn't even really taste of that much.
Yeah.
People are like, oh, you can really taste the meadow sweet. I'm like, can you? Are you just imagining that you can? Yeah. Because it doesn't really taste
is
very
meadow
much.
Meadow sweet a lie we tell ourselves?
Meadow sweet is the lie we all tell ourselves.
Yes.
So every year there's something.
We had a year of sea buckthorn.
Oh, sea buckthorn is Oliver's most hated thing.
I love that, because you see it on the menu.
To make a good curd out of
it. And you'd be like, I want to taste that. This is amazing. No. This is atrocious. Why did anyone... Like, there's a reason you don't find it in Sainsbury's.
There's a reason.
Gross.
There's a reason they don't sell sea buckthorn all over the place.
Oh, my God. What is up with sea buckthorn?
The only thing... And it's so fiddly and annoying, but I have made a really nice curd out of sea buckthorn. And the reason it was good is because you couldn't taste the sea buckthorn anymore.
Because with enough cream and sugar,
sea buckthorn is great. Exactly.
No, I'm not joking. I think
it's just a pretty color, and that's it.
Nobody
just
wants
take
sea
it from
buckthorn.
Us. Don't want it.
I can do this all night.
Yeah, we can. We might start on the wine in a minute.
But let's talk about your food. Actually, okay. We are gonna. I've been cooking Andy's food. I've been harassing her on the phone all weekend,
no, it's
which
nice.
I feel really bad about.
No, it was
but
nice.
I just really wanted to get it right.
Oh, can I say actually? So for me, it was quite difficult to not come in, because I was like, "Oh, he's making Johnny cakes." I'm like, "Well, I'm coming in. I'm gonna." Yeah. I was like, "No, leave the man alone, Andrea. You sent him the recipe. He's a cook. He knows what he's doing." And I'm just like, I'm so controlling.
I really wanted you to come, but I was like,
"Oh,
you know,
I would
we
have
always
come."
Come, but
I was like,
why didn't you come?
I didn't, because I didn't want to bother you. I was like, oh my God, I'm just going to be so annoying.
I was texting her videos of my Johnny cakes, and she texted me videos of her mum making it. And I was saying, this is, but he's made
good Johnny cakes, people.
And now I do. Now I do.
Do you know what Johnny cake comes from? Johnny cake comes from Journey cake. So they used to make, they're basically fried dumplings. But I think most people are used to Jamaican fried dumplings, which are really big and they're deep fried. And a Johnny cake is an Antiguan version, or a bake, some people call them. And they're much smaller and they're pan fried. They were called journey cakes because people would take them to the fields to work. And so you'd get the Johnny cake and you'd get like a little salt fish, or you get something, and that would be like your packed lunch, basically. So that's why it's called a Johnny cake.
Talk to us about Wadadley Kitchen. Am I saying it correctly?
Yeah, you are saying it right. So Wadadley Kitchen.
This is your latest baby.
This is my latest project that I love so much, because it's about history. And to me, it's such an interesting way to learn about who we are, where we've come from, is through food, because it's the simple sort of baseline that we all understand and we all sort of share all the time. So what I realized about a year or so ago, when people talk about Caribbean food, what they generally mean is one quite crap version of Jamaican food that you can get from most takeaways here, like a bit of overcooked, dry microwave jerk chicken, some dry, not very good rice and peas with tinned peas, which drives me nuts, by the way. And peas are like, like pulses, like red beans or black-eyed peas or black beans. Also, I suddenly realised that, you know, there are like 7,000 Caribbean territories and everybody has a different version of Caribbean food. Everybody has their own cuisine. In Antigua, we have vinny dalish, we have dukana, which is like a white sweet potato, coconut, steamed dumpling and banana leaf. We have Johnny cakes, we have pepper pot, we have all sorts of things that nobody outside the Caribbean or people outside of Caribbean homes have really heard of. And the only ubiquitous dish really is jerk chicken, which is a made-up thing anyway that came later. So I started putting together recipes from all over the Caribbean, from Antigua, from Trinidad, from Barbados, from Guyana, from, you know, Barbuda, which is a little island just off of Antigua. Next year, I'm going to start going to the Caribbean and talking to lots of different people. I know I'm very brave. Oh, I'm very, very brave. Someone's got to do it. Someone's so got to do it.
Thank you so much for doing it for us.
I am a very kind woman, right?
We're going to pass a little hat for everyone to help Andy.
World's tiniest violin, right? But, you know, I was in Jamaica a few years back, and which is where my partner comes from. And it was just the saddest thing. There was a man selling the best chicken, barbecue, jerk chicken, on the side of the road. And it was like, good chicken. You know, you can smell it. I know good chicken from two blocks away. And before I've even seen it, I'm like, someone's making good chicken. I can smell it. It's like, cuckoo. Yes, the ninja. I am a ninja. How did you know?
And the chicken ninja.
The chicken ninja.
It takes one to know one.
Exactly. So I was like, wow, that guy's making great food. And I sort of got there and there was like four people. And I turned around and a block away, there was a Kentucky. And the queue for the Kentucky came down the steps, down the street and round the corner. And it was so depressing. And I just was like, oh, we cannot do this to ourselves. Because when you throw away food, the recipes, to me, that's throwing away ourselves. It's like throwing away the heart of our culture. This is the reason those things are important, is that our food history tells us about ourselves. It tells us where we've been. The influences throughout Caribbean cooking are like Indian and Portuguese and Chinese and French, and from all over the world, because so many different people have been through the Caribbean, some for the good, some for the bad, but they've left behind traces of themselves in the cuisine and in all the food, you know. So the dish we've done tonight, the vini dálush, I discovered it a couple of years ago because my mother said to me, oh, I used to have this pork dish when I was a kid and I really, really want it. And she couldn't remember what it was called and she kept describing it to me. And I was like, what is this thing? And then about 2 weeks later, she called me and she went, it's called vini dálush. And then I started trying to Google it and I couldn't find it anywhere.
You can't find it.
He tried. It's just nowhere. So then I called my cousin and I've got, as I told you earlier, I've got like 180 cousins. So I picked the right one, thankfully. Called my cousin Junior and said,
it's like going through the phone.
Yeah, like, oh God, who's going to know? I always go to Junior though because he always knows. So I called Junie, he's called Baden, and I said, Junie, would you have vini dálush? She went, oh yeah, man. And sent me this recipe. And it's basically, it just means it's meat that's been marinated in vinegar. That's the starting point. So in Antigua, it's vini dálush. In Portugal, it's called vinha dálush. And in Asian culture, it's called vindaloo. So it's the same dish. But that's what's fascinating to me, is that you can take that one dish and suddenly understand that Portuguese have been there and then the Indians were there as well. And the mixture of all of those things came up with something new. And I'm not really very purist about, like, I had a gooseberries, you know, my aunt would probably have a nervous breakdown. Put gooseberries in the vini dálush, but it's gooseberries. And I just thought it's acidity, let's put some sweet and acid in there. That's why we decided on the berries, wasn't it? So I think that it's not a holy grail. You don't find the recipe and go, right, that's the way you make vini dálush. You take it and that's your starting point, and then you put your voice in it and your dream and your breath.
You keep the spirit of it.
Yeah, you keep the spirit and then make it your own. I think you must. I think it's really important.
It is delicious. It is really, really tasty. I have just like a couple more questions and we're going to feed you guys, of course.
Then they get like very hungry.
Hungry, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Take the lock off that door. Make it a run for it.
They're also ninjas.
Also ninjas.
No, once we start talking about the food, we need to know.
Yeah.
So you kind of carved your own path in a way. Do you feel that a lot of doors were open to you that weren't have been open, or a lot of doors were closed to you that were open to men, say, or doors that were open to you that were only open to you because of your unique life experience? Because this is our woman series.
I understand what you're asking me. I think this is what happens whenever change is afoot, is that the old guard, whoever they are, become very protective about their territory and their space. So you look up and you think, oh my God, why are you looking at me like that? And it's like, because you're not them and you're not who they expected to come next. So they can get a little bit, but you know, you just charm them up. I just
you charm them up.
I just sweet them, yes. Just nice them up. You know, Nana's dad taught me that, actually. Just, like, kill them with kindness, kill them with love. And, you know, in the end, they just have to relax and breathe and know you're not after them. You're just with them. And that's all right. You're not trying to take their space. You're just trying to have some of your own.
Yeah.
You know?
I have to say, I was last week at the, was it 40 years to the food
program? Oh, the food program.
Yeah, which Andy hosted, and everybody was there, like all the food
really
people.
Fancy pants.
And this one was wearing a gorgeous red T-shirt, can I call it? It was a lot of leg, high heels, strutting her stuff on the stage, running the whole show.
Yes, dear.
Running the whole show. Mm-hmm. Your establishment.
Apparently so.
You are establishment.
You said that to me earlier. I find that so peculiar as a concept. But I guess so. I mean, you know, the establishment changes, doesn't it, you see? The kind of component parts change every once in a while. And if it's changed and I'm now one of the component parts of that establishment, then good.
No, yeah, absolutely.
Good, because they need some fire.
Yeah.
And they need new breath and they need new air. Any establishment always does. I mean, that's the problem with it being, you know, with an established sort of set of mores and codes and ways of doing things. It can't stay that way. Change is inevitable. Change is good. So when change comes along and you're on your horse, then hold on tight.
And how does it feel for you personally?
I feel great. I do, though. I feel fantastic. You know, all my life, people have said to me, oh, you're so powerful, Andrea. And I think, what are you talking about? I feel terrible. I'm skin. I've got, you know, it's a nightmare. And now I'm like, oh, I am. I'm good. I feel great. I can, you know, I feel like I've got the chance finally to use my whole brain and my whole spirit and my whole everything. And that's what people want from me rather than a pared down version of me. Because I think for a long time, there was a bit in the middle where I would do things and people go, that's really great, but I'm still a bit scared of you. And now they're like, oh, give me more. So I, you know, and I've got more to give. So it just feels fantastic. And I want to write now and, you know, we did a literature festival, my daughter and I, the other day at Cheltenham, that was the best fun ever. And working with my daughter is just such a gift, honestly. So I just feel like life is great and I want to stand tall in it and let the sun rain down on me, and I'm enjoying every second.
Man, what are we going to say? Can we end in any other way? Wow.
That interview was part of our series, Who Run the World? Celebrating Women in Food. Our final episode will air on the 8th of March. It's International Women's Day. Thanks to our guest, Andy Oliver. Thank you also to all the incredible women of Honey & Co., especially Louisa Cornford. She helps us with everything podcast, and to Miranda Hinckley, the producer. Drop us an email with your thoughts, feedbacks, questions. You can email us at podcast@honeyandco.co.uk, or you can find us on social media at Honey & Co. We'd absolutely love to hear from you. Click subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to get the rest of the series. See you next time.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.